What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Max Hillebrand is a Rothbardian crypto anarchist, sound money agorist, free and open source software entrepreneur building at Wasabi Wallet, and is the founder and curator of the website Towards Liberty. Max is a content creating machine, deploying knowledge in various formats, including the written word, videos, podcasts, conferences, and Socratic seminars, all while he codes Bitcoin defensive weapons of war out of his 3-ton flatbed truck that he bought for Bitcoin on eBay and then dropped a shipping container onto the back of it. Max is a true Bitcoiner. He believes that Bitcoin is for everyone. Even his grandmother runs a node, and he practices what he preaches. Max lives a digital, nomadic, and global existence, only utilizing Bitcoin for every single thing in his life, ruthlessly minimizing his exposure to fiat shitcoins. Max Hillebrand, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Well, thank you very much, Cedric, for that awesome intro. that got me pumped.
Yeah, man. Well, I've been really looking forward to this conversation for a long time. From before I did the pod, you know, you've been someone who's really interesting to me in the space. I've kind of gotten to learn a lot about you since I started the pod. You know, it's interesting when you get to come across someone on Twitter, and maybe you see a tweet, maybe you listen to one podcaster on, you get a really one slice of life or one little perspective on somebody, and then kind of take in what you've been doing, and it kind of blows me away. And so kind of just to get started, like, I mean, you became an entrepreneur when you were 9. How did you start working at 9?
Well, I think it was a realization that, well, if you want to, you know, have some nice things, you got to work for them, right? You have to somehow create it and make it happen. It's not just going to drop out of the air. And like, that was a mindset that I'm really thankful for my mom, actually, because I mean, on, you know, the fundamental needs of food and shelter and clothing and all that, I was never lacking. But whenever it was about like these, you know, luxury goods that you know, I might just fancy for whatever reason, I always had a very high time preference for those. Like, if I want something, I want it now, right? And like, you know, that's somewhat of a normal attribute, but low time preference is a virtuous skill, right? And so my mom kind of instilled that on me with saying, well, if you want to have that latest and newest toy, well, earn some money and buy it for yourself, right? And this type of mindset really, well, encouraged me to go out there and to be productive and try to solve problems for others. So they give me money, so I get my toys. Right? And that really was fundamental in my childhood.
Yeah. Were you someone who were like, you were buying every single toy that you wanted? Or was it a little bit more of you worked like maybe a few months to save up for the toy?
Yeah, I wouldn't even say that I was like too much obsessed with getting all the latest toys. But I did want to have a couple things, right? I wanted to have them badly. And of course, you know, your need is endless, right? There are countless things that you would like to have. But what the earning the money really taught me was that shit is not free, right? You have to work for it and sacrifice for it. And that made me realize that there's always a trade-off. Like, I worked very hard to get all that money. Do I really want to spend it on this plastic crap? Right. So this type of, you know, opportunity cost was something that was also, you know, very important to learn at that age, because, again, only once you put in the labor and you actually sacrifice to create something, only then do you really see the value and, you know, what it took to get there. So this was something that, yeah, again, I really appreciate to have experienced at that age.
Sure. And then at some point, I guess you start reading up and studying how to just get incrementally better at, you know, creating value for your peers or whoever you're selling to. So what were you diving into?
Yeah, so I was just curious of the question of how can I do a better job, right? And ultimately get more money, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, get that realization of being appreciated and getting value into the community, right? And of course, you know, if you're curious about that, first you look at what is the mainstream talking about, and that is, of course, Keynesian economics. And this is where I at first, you know, started diving into. They didn't even teach that crap at school yet. So I just started picking up books and listening to, you know, YouTube videos and podcasts and things to learn about how, you know, that Keynesian economics works. And like throughout that time, I always had the feeling that something is off, something doesn't really make sense. Like, it was a beautiful model, and like inside that model, you could make great calculations and like super abstract things, but I was like, it never really answered my problem or my question of how do I become a better entrepreneur, right? How do I provide more value for people? How do I fix more problems more efficiently, right? So it was always lacking. And that like really got fostered this kind of, how do you call it? Like the curiosity, or like the kind of like this is bullshit attitude. Like something is up here. This doesn't make sense, or I'm stupid, but I don't get it. So there must be a more obvious and simple solution.
Yeah. And then at some point you come across, I guess, Austrian economics, and, you know, maybe Rothbard spoke to you more. Could you talk a little bit about like what it is to be a Rothbardian, or why Rothbard is a little bit, you know, more important to you than say the others? Or I don't want to say more important to you, but just, I mean, you call yourself a Rothbardian.
Yes, because Rothbard, I think, was probably the one economist that was most logically consistent in pretty much all of his arguments. His entire work of knowledge and his incredibly breadth of understanding was based on a simple axiom that individuals exist and that they act. And out of that, just logically deducing like an incredible, incredible amount of conclusions and realizations that, because all of them were logically coherent based on that axiom, just made sense intuitively. Like, this is really what impresses me so much about Rothbard. I mean, the guy wrote like, you know, 8 pages an hour, right, of high quality textbook material on the typewriter, right? It's ridiculous. Like, he was really a knowledge articulation machine. And in all that quantity of work, he never reduced his quality. Like, it was always razor sharp and witty and humorous to read, with that underlying kernel of truth in every little passage.
Sure. Do you think he was a little bit more anti-authority, or a little bit more kind of pushing back against the state than maybe some of the other authors or his contemporaries in that regard?
Yes, I think, and especially Mises, he was a very gentleman. I mean, like the picture-perfect gentleman, right? Just for him, in that mindset, in that culture, right, early Vienna, is like a much more of a diplomatic and polite attitude, right? And sometimes at the sacrifice of logical consistency, right? Like, he does make defensive arguments in favor of a minarchist state, basically, which is, of course, contradictory to everything he stands for. So that was something that bothered me. While Rothbard really is this in your face, these are my principles, this is the logic. If it doesn't make sense to you, well, sorry, I don't have the time to explain and convince you, right? I'm just going to tell you that you're stupid and that your argument is flawed here, here, and here, right? And with all that like rigor and joy, again, never sacrificing these principles or even the approach of how to approach such an argument.
Yeah, I hear you. And I definitely want to start digging into some of the Rothbard itself. I think the world needs more Rothbard. One of his quotes that, you know, opens the book is, "The greatest danger to the state is independent intellectual criticism." And this is kind of one of these quotes that, you know, if I read this when I was 15 years old, I would have been even angrier than I already was. You know, it's piercing. And this was written in 1974. And just to kind of broach a little bit about, you know, top of the show, I mentioned that, you know, you get to know someone from a tweet or a podcast, and you're getting to know someone as you go down that rabbit hole on maybe a particular voice. And you're in that regard, this book kind of really helped me understand more about you, I feel, as little as I do know about you, in terms of like even just, you know, how you come across and the different things I've learned about you with the things you're working on. So I really just want to jump into it in terms of the anatomy of the state and what is the state or what the state is not. And are we the people the same as we the government?
Yeah, I think this question, are we the people? Aren't we all the government? Right? That, I think, is the underlying crux of the issue. We have here two fundamentally opposing points of view of the world. Either you assume that the individual exists, right? That you exist, right? You are listening right now. You are acting in this very moment. And this is just something that you take for granted, right? You don't even question it. That's just your starting point of reasoning, right? And very much contrary to that, we have the collectivist view, right? That at the very base level, the collective exists, right? We're all groups and classes and nations, right? Just the individual is just the byproduct of the collective, right? The individual is how the collective expresses itself. And because these two different points of view could not be any more fundamentally opposite, right? Any system that you build on top will, like, it contrasts to each other, could be completely contradictory and absolutely lunatic, right? Because we even diverge at the very starting point. So sure, if you are a collectivist thinker, yes, we all are the government, right? And we don't really act, but it's just the will of a greater good of this collective society that makes us all do what we do, and we're just all a clog in this machine. Well, sure, yes, you're a Keynesian, you're a Marxist. But if you think that, no, I am a sovereign individual, I have my own will, I have my own problems, and I make choices on how to solve these problems, right? And I am that genius creative spark that brings order out of this chaos. If that is your mindset, well, welcome, you're an anarchist, basically. Because anarchy is the logical conclusion that will come from having that starting point.
I hear you on that. And can you maybe expand a little bit on the concept of, like, voluntary participation? You know, there's this notion, and this is what Rothbard talks about in the book, with the rise of democracy, the identification of the state with society has been redoubled. And what I'm getting at here is, like, let's say, you know, through democracy, 75% of the people vote to do a particular thing. And let's say that thing is not something that, you know, the 30 other percent agree with or something like that. Can you speak to maybe voluntary participation and what that the ramifications of that are?
Yeah, again, something really, really fundamental, right? If individual exists and individual acts, well, what does that actually mean, right? That means that the individual has problems, right? And he can think about a future where the problem is solved, right? He can think of a better situation in the future, right? And he has the power to make that future happen, right? To act, to solve his problem, and to change the situation around him, right? So with this individual mindset, well, who is the one who knows about the problems and what he wants to and how he wants to solve them? Right? Of course, only the individual knows that. Nobody else knows what you like. Like, do you prefer apples or do you prefer bananas? I don't know, right? That's really up to you. And even for you, it will change from when you were a young kid to where you are now. And when you're a grandpa in the future, right? Your preferences will change and fluctuate with every act that you do, right? So ultimately, nobody knows what you want, right? And we can only see what you actually do, right? And how you act. And that tells us about your preferences. But how does this trade into to aggression? Well, aggression is basically someone else saying that I know better for you. I will make this choice for you of how you must act or what you must consume, right? And what you are not allowed to do. So this is basically someone else saying that he knows better than you do about what you actually want, or even that it's irrelevant of what you want because you must act for the greater good of the collective. Right? This is again where these two fundamental opposing views clash. Right? If the individual does not want to do something, well, fuck it, he doesn't do it, right? And if he wants to do it, he's gonna do it. But in that collectivist view, if the individual even thinks about contradicting the status quo and what the collective body has chosen to be the right thing to do, well, then he is crushed and completely extinguished, as nobody is allowed to diverge from that collective body.
Yeah, I agree. And I think to further hammer home this point, you know, Rothbard goes on to state that the government does not in any accurate sense represent the majority of the people. But even if it did, even if 70% of the people decided to murder the remaining 30%, this would still be murder and would not be voluntary suicide on the part of the slaughtered minority. So now that, you know, we've kind of, what is the state and what is the state not? What is the state? And what does that mean to be the state, and who is a part of it, and what is the state trying to do?
Yes, I would say it's organized aggression on a large scale, right? So then the question is, what is aggression? I would say that this is the appropriation of the property right of an individual against his will. Right, so somebody does not want you to have the T-shirt that I'm wearing right now. Right, so if you take it against my will, you take a scarce property from my hands, and I had the explicit will of not to do that. Right, then you are aggressing against me. You are initiating aggressive force, and that is violence. Right, and that is, according to this point of view, just simply bad and intolerable. But there's, of course, a difference, right? Do you have like a small petty thief who just, you know, takes your phone out of the pocket and runs away, right? That's sure. I mean, he's a criminal, right? He just stole from you, but he's not necessarily the state, right? I think the state is, well, almost like a type of mythology or religion that justifies this aggressive behavior for some selected priest class. So there are some individuals that do have, for whatever reasons, the right to steal from others and to take their stuff, while others must tolerate that. Right? So I think that differentiation between a master class and the slave class, and specifically ideological backing of this point of view, both from both religion and, you know, science, or however you want to call this this thing today, that makes such a behavior normal and tolerated in society, I think this is where the state emerges.
Yeah, I agree. We're going to touch on religion and science a little bit further in the talk, but I'm kind of curious, you know, how does the state then preserve itself?
Well, yeah, you know, fundamentally, the state is not productive. It cannot be. The state can create nothing of value. Why? Well, because we don't, like, everything is forced, right? There is no voluntary interaction. So we don't know if the individuals that interact with the with state authorities actually benefit from the situation, right? Because they have no choice, right? They're being whipped and held at gunpoint. Of course, you're not going to do what you want if someone puts a gun to your face. Right? Mm-hmm. So just by that simple fact, the state cannot create value. It cannot solve problems. It cannot be productive. Right? And it's a parasite, right? It needs to take that energy from someone else, from productive people. Right? A thief alone on the lonely island is useless. Right? He cannot steal from anyone. He needs someone else to steal from him. Right, in order to survive. And this is a very parasitic behavior. So how does the state class survive? Well, by continuously leeching on productive entrepreneurs who actually solve problems for people. Therefore, then kind of the solution to the state is for those productive people to withdraw their consent and their obedience towards such a state apparatus, and with censorship resistance and permissionless technology, simply act without being stolen from. It's somewhat of an Atlas Shrugged situation.
Yeah. It's interesting you use the word parasite. And, you know, to me, when I first came to Bitcoin and the word parasite about sort of like the ruling class or the political class or the intellectual class was very like... you know, it was kind of obtuse, and it was jarring. And it's interesting, I'm going to pull a quote from Rothbard. The state provides a legal, orderly, systematic channel for the predation of private property. It renders certain, secure, and relatively peaceful the lifeline of the parasitic caste in society. And again, there, a reference that this book was written in 1974. If I had come to this kind of material earlier in my life, it would have been another enlargement of the reframing of the world I got to know just at an earlier time. And I wonder there, like, how much of this, of these writings by Rothbard and everybody else, you know, and his contemporaries was suppressed. And my next question for you is, you know, does the state need and use intellectuals to preserve itself?
Yes, I very much think so. Mises writes beautifully about the power of ideas, right? Because ideas are utmost powerful. Why? Because they are non-scarce goods, right? They can be shared among others without the sacrifice of giving them up, right? The words I speak to you right now, I retain for myself, right? I keep that information. It even grows for myself, right? But you gain the richness of this content as well. It's beautiful, right? It's incredibly powerful. And of course, as any technology, can be used for good or for bad, right? For prosperity or for thieving. And like, information is so powerful because it compels the action, right? Any action, as the Trivium teaches, starts with knowledge accumulation, right? First, you take in external information, right? And as a second step, you process it. You try to understand it, right? To reach conclusions about that information that you just took in. Is it true? Is it false? And what should I do now? Right? As the final step is action, right? Based on that information that you accumulated and come to understand, then you will act, right? That's the only way that humans act, basically. So if the information that you take in is poisoned, is useless, is false, right, is perceptive and misleading, then your actions will be misguided as well, inevitably, right? So very much the state apparatus relies on propaganda of all types of form to spread misinformation and uncertainty and doubt, and especially fear, so that it confuses the minds of individuals to no longer act reasonably and within truth, and to no longer think for themselves. Because if they would, very quickly they would stop supporting this apparatus and the parasite would perish.
Yeah. And I think also to tip off on what you mentioned before about religion and science, I think this is where, you know, in the state's interest, it's their best interest is to move people away from religion. And I'm not getting into whether religion is good or bad for people. I think where they're moving us people away from religion more towards secular science and experts. And in the present, more secular age, the divine right of the state has been supplemented by the invocation of a new god, science. Rule is now claimed as ultra-scientific as planned by the experts, which is another quote from Rothbard. And, you know, it makes me think of some other devices that the state is using to sort of, preserve itself, which is tradition. So sort of like worshiping ancestors kind of nudges us towards worshiping one's ancient rulers. And another one, I think, that Rothbard gets into is guilt. So unconscionable greed, materialism, and excessive affluence. And can you maybe touch on how, I think that's another way of them pitting the individual versus the collective.
Yes, exactly, right? If the dogma is from everyone according to his ability, to each according to his needs, right? Then if someone is better off than you, if someone has solved a problem that you are still suffering from, right, whatever that is, well, then of course you're going to be envious, because look at that fucker. He is like super prosperous and he has got all his problems solved. Why doesn't he solve my problems, right? We're all in this together, right? And it's going to be for the greater good if you just solve all my problems and I take all the stuff that you have, right? This envy, this jealousy is, I think, a consequence of this mindset. And we see it wherever socialism was advanced even more than it is now, right? Like communist Russia fascist Germany, envy was at the root of it all. And you know, there were even sayings like, if you don't steal from your neighbor, you steal from your family, right? Which of course in such a communist regime is exactly what is happening, right? Everyone is stealing from everyone. And there's a massive incentive towards doing that, which is just a sickening of many incentives.
Yeah, I agree. And I want to read this quote from Ibid, from Anatomy of the State, that Rothbard quotes: "The average man, whatever his errors otherwise, at least sees clearly that government is something lying outside him and outside the generality of his fellow men, that it is a separate, independent, and hostile power, only partly under his control and capable of doing him great harm. Is it a fact of no significance that robbing the government is everywhere regarded as a crime of less magnitude than robbing an individual or even a corporation? What lies behind all this, I believe, is a deep sense of the fundamental antagonism between the government and the people it governs. It is apprehended not as a committee of citizens chosen to carry on the communal businesses of the whole population, but as a separate and autonomous corporation, mainly devoted to exploiting the population for the benefit of its own members. When a private citizen is robbed, a worthy man is deprived of the fruits of his industry and thrift. When the government is robbed, the worst that happens is that certain rogues and loafers have less money to play with than they had before. The notion that they have earned that money is never entertained. To most sensible men, it would seem ludicrous. You know, I think you touched on a lot of those points before, and I think it's just interesting to quote it from Ibid as well, to just outline how, you know, long these thoughts and principles have been around. And you know, I think, again, that I think it speaks to the suppression of information and education. And one other thing I wanted to touch on is just like the notion of like public land or public parks, which are interesting because a lot of times those things have mandatory open and close hours. And can you speak to a little bit of like, you know, again, it's like, who is the state if like certain people have access to that park when it's closed?
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous. Like, what is the audacity of just a small group of people getting together and pointing on the map on like this gigantic territory and saying, well, you are not allowed to use that anymore, right? This is all national land now, and the collective owns it, right? And for any productive person, making that land unattainable, I mean, that's just so ridiculous, especially at the scale that this is done. I mean, such a vast amount of land on this planet, all of it is in some way, shape, or form claimed by this collective identity of us, the government. But of course, as you say, there is no us, the government. They are just bureaucrats and bootlickers and these individuals who manifest the state into existence by their action. So it's like, it's not that we own it. You and I have no ownership right whatsoever in this land, right? The bureaucrat does, right? And whatever crony he's going to convince to sign that law, however he then wants to use it, right? Public land is an absolute strategy, and it cripples the productive capacity of this entire planet to an utter extent. Here again, the seen and the unseen. What we could have built with all these resources, if only they were in the hands of genius private individuals.
Yeah, I agree. How does the state transcend its limits?
That's a great question. So I guess its limits are, as a myth, right?
Through the king and stuff.
Exactly, right? It's there has to be some fancy story that is being told, which leads individuals to believe the conclusions that are laid out in front of them. But always only talk about the conclusions, right? That, well, it's just how it is that we pay like 95% taxes to the state. That's just, you know, how a healthy society functions, because we're all in this together, right? Only talk about the conclusions and never reveal the underlying reasonings that lead to these conclusions. Critical thinking is the end of the state, right? Because as soon as you think critically about this apparatus, you will realize that it's bogus, that it's a complete nonsense, that it does not make sense. It is just factually wrong and incoherent. So that is why I like to say that the state is a myth, it's a mythology. It is a religion of authority that these bogus people somehow gain privileges over my body and my mind for some unknown reason, just because they say so. As soon as you start questioning this myth critically, I think that you will realize that anarchy is, again, the logical outcome.
Yeah. Interesting points you bring up there. And I wonder, you know, is the United States Constitution a myth?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, I think it was set out in, of course, good intentions. But as we know, the road to hell is paved with those. And we see it now. I mean, just in hindsight, over the last, 300 years, America has evolved into the largest fascist tyranny that we've seen in recent times, like incredible amounts of warfare and death and suffering. So obviously, right, the document did not set out what it tried to achieve, right? Now the question is why? And again, I just think because it was fundamentally flawed. Like, many kernels of truth were in there, but ultimately it still gave the right of some arbitrary body of men to make decisions for others. And as long as this is even like the hint of this collectivism is in a system that you set out, that you create, I think it's just fundamentally doomed to fail just for lack of reason. This is why, well, I think Bitcoin, for one, is interesting because it is very much consistent with individuality and with freedom, hopefully to a big enough of an extent, and hopefully we did not miss some of the collectivist spooks in the fundamental building blocks of the system, because if we did, I think it's going to crumble down.
What does the American Project mean to you, either as, you know, a reference point in human civilization and for what it was, and what is it now to you, and is it relevant to you?
Well, I think it was one manifestation of the individual freedom that is inherent in existence. We did not discover freedom in the 1700s as we discovered America. Like, individuals were free before then. They have always been. That's just how they are, right? So, yes, it was a phenomenal advancement in rediscovering this individual star and building a worldview around that. But it wasn't the first one. It won't be the last one, right? This is something, to my opinion, like really fundamental to individual existence. And we will continuously struggle to try to manifest it to a full extent. It might even be arguable if it is even possible to have this coherent, fundamentally sound society that does not eat itself alive, right? That's a big question, but maybe us monkeys can figure that out.
What does the state fear, you know, besides intellectual criticism and critical thinking? And in other words, like, how can a state die?
Resistance, I would say. To withdraw your consent, to simply not follow the orders. I think this is it. Like, as soon as someone shouts an order at you and you think critically about that order and you come to the conclusion that that's bullshit and I won't do it, poof, the state is gone, right? It is no longer manifest. The coercion has basically stopped. Of course, there will be answers by state authorities, right, to try to reclaim that power over your mind and your body. So there will be a conflict, right, for sure. But fundamentally, as soon as one realizes that there is no state, these are all just a bunch of clowns in uniforms trying to steal stuff from me, and I'm not going to have it. I'm not going to take that anymore, right? That is basically it. I think the rest, the following the collapse of the state will logically follow once the individual takes this action.
Right. Yeah. So basically, I mean, war from within, or even war from, you know, the outside, is the way that the state can die and what it fears most. And I think in both scenarios, it's in a constant state of war, constant state of defense and emergency against both those issues. How do you think war has maybe evolved over the centuries? And what I'm really kind of getting at here is, like, what is war like in the 21st century? Is it more psychological than physical than ever before? Or has it always been psychological? Or maybe it's not psychological right now. I don't want the words in your mouth.
Oh, yeah, that's actually a nice rabbit hole to dig down to, because I think we had like three different eras, or at least like three noteworthy areas to talk about here. Like, first is war under a sound monetary system, right? Like, for example, gold. So this basically means that, well, if you want to go to war, you will have to pay the soldiers, you will have to pay for the armor and the weapons and the ammunition and the food, right? And the massive supply chain of a war, a war apparatus. And, well, if you're going to spend all that money, well, you're only going to do it if you think it's profitable, right? If somehow at the end of this war effort, you're going to be better off despite you having invested so much capital into fighting it. Right. So basically, there's skin in the game. Right. If you want to go to war, you got to pay for it. Nobody else is going to pay for it. Right. And this, I would say, reduces the scope of the war in general, right? Because it's not a profitable venture going out and destroying the stuff from others. Like, you're just going to make everyone poorer, including yourself. Right? So I think that in a in a society where property rights are actually defended, specifically on the monetary base side of things, right? This is where a great reduction of crime and war, especially mass crime at scale, which is war, will become less and less profitable. And we've seen in the 20th century what the fiat regime can do to the war machinery.
Right. Yeah. Would you, on that note, would you agree with Robert Breedlove that, you know, Hitler would not be a household name without fiat?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So with a hard monetary asset, it just becomes unprofitable to wage war because you're going to have to give up your precious gold or Bitcoin in order to hire the soldiers and buy the ammunition and the armor and all the things. Right. The tragedy of the 20th century was the creation of a fiat central banking regime to legitimize the stealing via printing of money, and specifically to use this massive apparatus to steal capital from everyone and to fund a war machine with that. We saw it, of course, with Hitler, who financed this, or what we've seen before that with in the First World War, where a decoupling from the gold standard in most countries that were affected by the war took place simply to print money in order to pay soldiers, right, to steal from everyone so that they can, you know, fight for the greater good of ending whatever evil they were proclaiming. Of course, all just a scam to shift capital from the productive people to the looters, nothing else. And that theme continued in the Second World War and in the Cold War, and of course in the American war that we are living in recently, right? I mean, all these oil wars and our OPEC wars to back the power of the printing press, specifically the fiat regime, to have oil trades denominated in the US dollar. Right? That's why it's called right. The petrodollar. That's right. Why every single war in the Middle East is being fought for all these years, right? So in a sound monetary economy, war becomes unprofitable. While in a fiat regime, war is the perfect excuse to print even more money and to steal even more.
Yeah. I mean, my whole life, America's been at war overseas and in many places every year. And it's also seemed like since I was very young, there was the war on drugs, then the war on terrorism, and now the war on, you know, germs and viruses. How do you think states relate to each other?
Yeah, that is an interesting question because, right, I mean, at least on paper, right, these nation states are independent from each other, right? Each claim to be the sovereign authority and the local mafia boss over this territory, right? And there's only one mafia boss in town. So basically, we live in anarchy on a macro scale, right? There is no one official ruler above all governments, but they just rule their own property, their own slaves that they have. So, but nevertheless, right, as with every mafia, it is profitable to form a cartel, right, and to collude with other thieves to make sure that the thieving stays profitable for a long time. And I think we see that especially in the year 2020, where basically every government on the entire planet all of a sudden started stealing by the same rule book, right? Unleash fear of a virus, shut down productive businesses so that they no longer get any incoming cash flow, and then print money so that we dilute their capital savings, right? That is like stealing on both fronts, incoming cash flow and capital reserves. Absolutely ridiculous. And every government did it at the same time, coordinately, right? So this for sure recently, I probably especially with the advent of the information age and just as that extra step towards globalization and the ultimate socialist dream of having a one world government, I think we've just recently in this year really see that advance to a scary extent.
Right. And to touch off on what you're saying with the money printer go burr, I do want to switch over just one excerpt from What Has Government Done to Our Money by Rothbard. And in this excerpt, inflation has other disastrous effects. It distorts that keystone of our economy, business calculation. Since prices do not all change uniformly and at the same speed, it becomes very difficult for business to separate the lasting from the transitional and gauge truly the demands of consumers or the cost of their operations. For example, accounting practices enter the cost of an asset at the amount the business has paid for it. But if inflation intervenes, the cost of replacing the asset when it wears out will be far greater than the recorded on the books. As a result, business accounting will seriously overstate their profits during inflation and may even consume capital while presumably increasing their investments. Similarly, stockholders and real estate holders will acquire capital gains during an inflation that are not really gains at all, but they may spend part of these gains without realizing that they are thereby consuming their original capital. And that just really, I think, speaks to me for like the Weimar everywhere. And just, you know, people think that they're getting richer, but they're really just consuming their original capital. And I think that's a scary place government has put us in. My next question for you is, how is history a race between state power and social power?
That's an interesting one. What do you mean by social power?
I guess by the power of the people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's always a race, right? Some people want to steal from you. They want to eat your food and to rape your children, basically. Yeah. And you, of course, don't want that to happen. I think that cycle of aggression and defense is unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, something very deeply rooted in the humans. And it's a constant, I think it's a constant struggle for technology. Offensive, like offensive and defensive technology or weapons, right? How good are you to protect your property rights, and how good is the aggressor to come and take them, right? And which one of you is the better one? And I think, again, especially in the 20th century and even more so in the 21st, we see that the state apparatus has achieved enormous scale, specifically with, you know, tools like internet propaganda and such, that it became all of a sudden so much cheaper to, well, mind wash and steal from everyone at a much faster rate. And just things like surveillance, right? 40 years ago, the Stasi agents still had to actually, you know, drive through the town in a van and listen to what people were saying, right? Right. Nowadays, everyone is carrying a microphone, camera, and GPS locator perfectly identified to their name, where government bureaucrats, of course, have access to every single movement that you make. I mean, so much more efficient, right? Replace robot with monkey. And that has happened in the aggressive part of the technology. But there's somewhat of a bright side, because we have discovered in the 1970s or so, with the advent of strong cryptography, this unbreakable defensive technology of strong encryption, right? To be able to speak without anyone else realizing what you speak, right? So you just say something, but the other person does not understand you. Now, that aspect of being private, right, to selectively reveal yourself to the world and to simply choose not to interact with the bureaucrat, right, and not to speak to the bureaucrat by encrypting your communications, was a massive, massive improvement to the defense of the individual. And I think that, well, the early internet shows a promise for what it could be, but it also shows like the unfortunate downside of the massive surveillance state as we see it right now. Right. And I think what was lacking was a sound money in cyberspace to allocate the resources of defense more efficiently, right? And I think Bitcoin is that genius new instrument that makes private property contracts unfuckwithable completely. Not a single Bitcoin has ever been stolen, not once. Every single Bitcoin transaction provided a valid signature script. Not a single one had a fake signature and got confirmed. Like, not a single private property contract was broken ever in Bitcoin. There was no state, no successful state attack where someone spent the coins that he actually was not, did not have the right to spend. Not once, right? That's genius. That's absolutely incredible. We've made the state impossible to succeed. Like, he's not going to get your Bitcoin if he doesn't have your private keys, right? That's a phenomenal, phenomenal achievement. And I think the long-term consequences of that will make a lot of the state workflows unprofitable again.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And you know, I want to get into a little bit of what you just said, but before I unpack that, I want to read my final quote from the book that Rothbard wrote. In this century, the human race faces, once again, the virulent reign of the state. Of the state now armed with the fruits of man's creative powers, confiscated and perverted to its own aims. The last few centuries were times when men tried to place constitutional and other limits on the state, only to find that such limits, as with all other attempts, have failed. Of all the numerous forms that governments have taken over the centuries, of all the concepts and institutions that have been tried, none has succeeded in keeping the state in check. The problem of the state is evidently as far from solution as ever. Perhaps new paths of inquiry must be explored. If the successful final solution of the state question is ever to be attained. And I think he's kind of really hinting at the future to come and that we've arrived at with Bitcoin and how Bitcoin is a weapon of self-defense. And could you maybe talk a little bit about how you live Bitcoin to, you know, as part of an ethos of your life and how you ruthlessly avoid fiat shitcoins and what that means to you?
Yeah, quickly to that quote of Rothbard. I mean, he's brilliant, isn't he, right? Mm. He understands that this is such a difficult problem, right? And that it's currently unsolved. I mean, obviously. Right? Look at the 20th century. A fucking shit show. Like, horrible. Absolutely horrible. Like, we failed as a human species, like, tremendously. As a funny thing, like, as you hinted, he kind of gives that glimpse of a potential solution. And I did this fun experiment where I did an audiobook of What Has Government Done to Our Money by Rothbard, but I replaced the word gold with the word Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Right? And funnily, it's spot on. Like, it's so good. It just makes so much sense in the context of Bitcoin. Quite a hilarious experiment, actually. So yeah, Rothbard really like laid the roots for Bitcoin to flourish. Just in a theoretical and methodological approach.
Right. You know, it's interesting. Again, I tip off a little bit about how, you know, on your Twitter profile, it says liberty or death, come and take it. And they have two swords up. And, you know, that was another thing that I've had to reframe over getting to know you via, you know, your appearances on podcasts and your voice on Twitter. And it's contrasted with, you know, your really rational, well out thought view on the world. And so I'd love to hear more about, you know, Bitcoin and what you're doing with Wasabi and how Wasabi enhances privacy for Bitcoiners and what are kind of the current implications of Wasabi and what might be some of the future implications of coin joining.
Yeah, so in my entire like way to think, I have this huge drive to be based on first principles and logically consistent. And to that extent, I'm very radical. Like, I hate when people don't know their assumptions and that they have flaws in their thinking. Like, it bugs me. I don't like it, right? So I get very, let's say, rough in my argumentation style, maybe very similar to as Murray Rothbard did it. but yeah, always with that, you know, somber and reasonable mind behind it, at least.
Well,
I
your
hope.
Soul seems so gentle. you know, so what I mean, those were five or six words that, you know, maybe the first time I saw a tweet, I jumped to the Twitter profile. I was like, whoa, who's this guy? You know, but, you know, getting to, you know your voice, like, I'm like, whoa, who's this guy? It's not the same exact voice as maybe you would confer or infer in five or six words. I think it's just about first principles for you. But it's just an interesting paradox to hear such strong conviction. Not that it's a paradox, but, you know, when you, just at first glance, you don't know, you're not getting the whole person.
Yeah, like this is somewhat stating my conclusions in just a few words without explaining my rationale behind it, right? Like these are just a couple words, liberty right. or death, come right. and take him, right? But they're like conclusions that I've worked for incredibly hard to reach, right? With countless hours of contemplating and researching to ultimately come to that, right? So yes, it's in your face and it's just a conclusion blurted out. Again, a bit similar to as Rothbard kind of does it. Like he has these very in-your-face, somewhat even, you know, almost considered aggressive statements But, you know, at the heart of it, he's just this jolly Jew who's giggling all the time.
Right.
very different character to when you actually get a conversation with him compared to when he's writing like a hit piece to diminish the latest Keynesian research papers. Mm. Right. There he's incredibly like offensive and in your face. Right. But reasonable. And his arguments make sense. But that's just the style to portray the enthusiasm for how much wrong that argument is and for right. how deeply you think that your side of the argument is correct. And I mean, yes, that can sound hypocritical to some extent if you have not done your research, right? But if you really have a solid, like theoretical and methodological like framework behind your actions and your thoughts, then sure, be balls out and, you know, say it as you mean it, because, well, you actually mean it, right? It's not just an empty floskel.
Yeah. To me, I mean, he seems or feels like the Lenny Bruce of economics. When he speaks, it's just extremely clear to me. I get a little angry in a good way, and I'm just amazed I didn't come across his material earlier in life. I'm a little disappointed in myself. I get mad at myself when I think about that.
It's kind of similar to foaming out that you missed out on buying Bitcoin at like 10 cents, right?
yeah, but I don't have that FOMO because, you know, I had the knowledge, you know, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I mean, I've made peace with, you know, I think every Bitcoiner should, you know, don't trade with your prior self in terms of, you know, that economic side of that trade. But, you know, I wish I learned more about Bitcoin earlier. I wish I heard more of this great information that I'm getting out of Austrianomics earlier. I'm very disappointed that I paid a lot of money, or even my parents were grateful they paid for me to go to undergrad, and I paid for myself to go to grad school. But, you know, 6 years of upper financial education, you know, 4 years of finance and 2 years of getting a master's in accounting, and to not come across this stuff is unnerving, you know. And I understand it's a result of the system, but it's just still like it boggles my mind.
Yeah, right. That hundreds of thousands, if not millions of self-proclaimed economists,
right,
go out there and give advice and like shape public mindset and policy.
Yep. Or not even offer contrasting advice, like not advice, contrasting schools of thought. Put, you know, let the ideas speak for themselves to speak of economics and not refer to Austrian economics. Because to me, it's almost silly to call it Austrian economics. I think that's a way of making it different. Like, it's just economics. You know, they just they have competing views, but like one is right, one is wrong. So to call it Austrian kind of like equates them. Well, you could be an Austrian or you could be a Keynesian. Like, no. It's like, you could be right or wrong. And I think it's just a way of reframing things. Like, I don't even think we should call ourselves Austrian economics.
Yeah. I like to call myself a praxeologist, just because it sounds fun.
I was going to ask you, what is praxeology? I mean, that's, you know, and I know it's human action in a nutshell, but that's just in terms of, that's another word that is not familiar in education, at least that I've seen amongst university college education in the States and amongst my peers whenever we talk. Like, that's a new word to me since I came to Bitcoin and Austrian economics.
Yeah. And so praxeology is the underlying fundamental way of thinking, like methodological approach, as well as the topic of what we think about, right? It kind of combines both of that. So first of all, it applies like an axiomatic a framework where you start with self-evident truths, as Mises says it, like and that is individual action, right? Individuals act, that is self-evident. We don't question the fact, because if you say, well, I, the individual, do not act, well, how did you just say that, right? You just acted and said that you don't act. That doesn't make sense, right? So therefore, we take this as our starting point, right? And then methodologically, we use deductive logic, right? Reasoning, the skills of grammar and of coherent thought, right? To deduce with logical principles, conclusions based on this, right? So this is both the methodological approach of starting with axioms and finishing up with critical thinking, as well as the subject or axiom is individual action. And therefore we think about what does that even mean, right? That gives us so much beautiful things. And economics is just a tiny subsection of praxeology, right? Human action goes so much deeper than just economic trade, right? It's arguably one of the most fascinating and important parts of praxeology, and it's for sure the most well-researched and articulated with all the great work that Austrians have done over the years. But praxeology really goes deeper. It's the science of individual human action in a sound methodological approach.
Right. Yeah. What if you know, if money or, you know, Bitcoin is money, and what would you use your money to not do? You know, most people think of money as like, oh, I would use my money to do this or that. But like, what would you use your money to not have to do?
Actually, I'm going to twist that question a bit. But like the beautiful thing of holding money is that it's an active statement that you do not want to invest. You do not want to consume right now, right? You don't want to spend your money on food. You don't want to eat right now, right? You also don't want to build a house right now, right? You neither want to consume nor you want to produce. And this is why you actually hold money. That's why you save your money, right? So holding Bitcoin is an active cry out that I don't want to invest my money, right? I don't want to spend my money right now. I just want to save for the future, right? I'm happy. I don't have any major problem that needs to be solved, right? I'm content and I'm willing to save for the future so that in the future I can have the capital that I need in order to fix my problems. So for me, that aspect of holding Bitcoin is like a self-confident statement that, you know, I'm content with how things are and I can deal with it, right? I don't have any unsolvable problems right now. So I will just save my capital that if in the future a difficult problem arises, I will have, you know, the ammunition to deal with it.
Right. What about if, let's say 10, 20, 30 years from now, Bitcoin is money. And let's say that you don't have a lot of Bitcoin and you need to make some Bitcoin. And there's no more coding that we need to make Bitcoin more private or enhance the defensive weaponry of Bitcoin. Do you have a skill or anything else that you would be doing to earn Bitcoin?
Well, I mean, one of the skills I think I have is like being that philosopher type, right? To have interesting ideas and somewhat of a skill to articulate them, and especially to help my peers to understand them. I think that's quite a valuable service in general, right? But I, like, even more so, I like to design the protocols and to think about like architectural solutions to problems of private property conflicts. So like, this is why I'm so interested in Bitcoin, is because it's a genius way to prevent thieves from stealing from you. And again, there will always be thieves. There will always be jealous idiots who want to take your stuff, right? So you will always have to keep up with finding solutions of how to defend yourself against them. So just that is kind of like a never-ending cat and mouse game that is really, you know, interesting for me in general. But you know, to answer your question truly, on like what would be one of the complete other things that I would love to do. Is, you know, actually like creating things out of natural materials is something I'm really fascinated in. So woodworking is really close to my heart and has, by the way, helped me a lot in building my truck. Most of it inside is made out of wood and just something that I really enjoy, not just to create, but also to live within and around. So this is probably something that I would focus my time on more if my mind would not be crazy with Bitcoin 24/7.
What is that lifestyle meant for you? Like moving around and being mobile and being able to wake up in different places and just appreciate something new and different. Is that something that you see as an extremely long-term, low time preference way of living or something else?
I think the thing that I learned most was just a realization of the extent of the choice that you actually have. Like, you don't have to live up like in that shitty town where you live right now, tomorrow. Like, you don't have to. You really don't. There are infinite amount of places where you could manifest and meet space. There are infinite amount of people that you could meet and have fun with. And there are so many problems all over the place that you could solve, right? Like, you don't have to be stuck in the same situation every single day for your entire life. You can make changes. You can make choices.
Yeah.
And just to actually live that and to realize it was incredibly helpful, because again, it helped me with my resource allocation, right? The reason why I love entrepreneurship and economics, right? What do I actually want, right? What is the thing that would make me most fulfilled, that would fix most of my problems, right? Or specifically, like, where is the place that I really want to be at? Like, I could be anywhere, right? Like 1,000 kilometers radius, and by tonight I'll be there. So, you know, where do I want to be? There are many, many choices. And that makes you think about who are the people that I really want to interact with, right? And in what places do I really want to interact with them? And if my current situation is not above that standard that I want for myself, and if there's a too large opportunity cost, well, you know, that sucks. You know, best example is Bitcoin conferences. Like, you being stuck in your town right now is shitty, because, well, we could have the honey badger, right? And hang out all Bitcoiners in our citadel, right? Like, those are kind of the nice, truly liberating aspects, is that realization that I am free and I can wake up tomorrow in a different place.
Yeah. It's very interesting. When I was 25, I had the opportunity to travel the South Pacific by myself for 3 months. And you really have that that meta existential, like, I'm not going to go to something that I don't want to do myself. So, you know, you want to visit this attraction, you want to go to that volcano or that ocean or that valley or whatever it is. It's on you. Like, only you can enjoy it. And you're not necessarily like taking it in with somebody. And now that I'm married, though, like, where home for me is wherever my wife and kids are. And that could be kind of nomadic, but at the same time, like, I remember, I don't know if you ever saw the documentary Rivers and Tides. It's about the artist Andy Goldsworthy, and he's a land artist. And it's very interesting that he had a quote where he said, you don't really live a full life until you've been in a place that you've seen people born and die, like the same individual born and die. And then on that regard, like, I've had a strong desire to grow roots. And yet every 7 or 10 years, I get an itch to, you know, kind of pick up and maybe change things. And it's just, and yet in a family dynamic, there's a lot of compromise to that, you know, and it would be interesting. I'm just really curious, you know, how you digest all that in terms of you being an individual and moving around and how that might affect your life going forward. But I'm in awe of how you live your life. Not that I'm comparing and contrasting, but I think it's really great the way you use Bitcoin for everything. I do think it's exciting what you're doing. Being able to wake up in different places and kind of use the flatbed truck and the shipping container as like kind of like a turtle, like a turtle shell. So I'm enjoying seeing it, you know.
Yeah, but I actually think that we're pretty much down the same alley here. And I think, you know, when we apply the point of view that I described earlier, that it really is your choice where you want to wake up tomorrow.
I agree. Yeah.
That means if you wake up with your family, right, and your wife next to you in bed, right, that means that this is the most, like, the bestest thing you could be doing right now.
100%,
like,
yeah.
This is proof that like, you love that person, and there is nobody else in this world that would be better in that situation.
Right.
So if the individual is truly free to choose, then this means that the choice that he makes is a proof, a irrefutable proof, that it was the best possible outcome that he thought he could achieve. Right. So it's an amazing compliment to your wife, right, if you still wake up next to her, because it means that she is literally the most amazing woman in your eyes. And there would be nothing, no one else that you would more rather spend your time with.
Yeah, 100%. I choose yes every day. I'm just grateful that she chooses yes every day, you know, and I just work hard for that. You know, my final question to you is, you know, how fundamental are private property rights or property rights to the foundation of civilization?
As like inevitably linked. Maybe I would go even a bit deeper. I forgot who said it. I think it was Hayek, that every meaningful achievement of the human society was a advancement towards subjectivism. And basically, like, subjectivism as a methodological approach is, again, in the individualistic line of thought, right? Subjective preferences of the individual, right? This is so, like, individuality is a consequence of thinking subjectively, right? And property rights are the conclusion of individual, like, of praxeology, right? So yes, absolutely. When we have more property rights, or when property rights are more respected, that means that people are thinking critically, right? And that they are reasonable, and, you know what they're thinking, like, know the question and find answers to the question. It's inevitably tight. And if we lose sight of that and we go back into a collectivist thinking, right, then this means we become less reasonable and we continue to degrade in the quality of our thoughts, which will inevitably lead to a degrading in the quality of our actions. Therefore lead to poverty, right? And to, well, a reduction of what I claim to be, like, good in, on the macro scale of society, like capital accumulation, is being completely contradicted here.
Right. Actually, I got one more, and it kind of speaks to citadels in the physical world, but do you have a preference for cities, beach, countryside, and do you one day... Do you believe in the physical citadel, or is it about the inner citadel, or both?
Meat space is fundamentally important. I mean, you know, you're, after all, just a sack of some meat and blood, right, as floating around in the space. So you're not going to get out of that, at least not soon. So this means you will have to defend your physical property, like your body first and foremost, right? If you're in prison and being raped, well, you're not free, and over, right? Regardless how free you might be in cyberspace. So we need to have a secure meat space in order that we can freely manifest ourselves in cyberspace and engage with other individuals, you know, on a sovereign ground. So yes, physical security, essential, absolutely essential, right? And so then the question is, like, where do I like that to be? The city, like... I love cities for the division of labor that they offer, and just the plethora of capital that is being accumulated there. You know, especially like beautiful cities like Vienna or Prague, right, or Venice are just breathtaking to walk through these masterpieces of architecture and wealth, right? Very pleasurable, and of course, all the entrepreneurs are there, right? If you want to get a problem solved, well, somebody in the city is going to do it, right? That's super, super useful. But my heart is very much in the forest. So I do seek that, you know, loneliness in the wild, basically, surrounded by nature, especially, you know, deep in the forest, which is one of the prime reasons why I'm actually so fond of living in this truck. Is that I can just park in the forest in the middle of nowhere with the nearest village like 20 kilometers away, and I can live there comfortably and have everything that I need in my shell. Right? That's one of the reasons why I choose this lifestyle, is just to be closer to nature in the places that, if you live in the city, are just unattainable for you.
Right. Yeah, and there's nowhere I feel more stripped of my rights and my physicality and my birthrights than when I go through airport security and they literally take everything out of my pockets, my phone, which is like an extension of my brain, and my identification, which is my only real defense against the state. And it's kind of unnerving to go through that moment. But, you know, on that note, I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this conversation. I've been looking forward to a long time, Max. I really appreciate you coming on the pod. I'm going to leave it to you for, you know, any parting words, and, you know, definitely let people know where they can find you. I know you're putting out a plethora of content as well as work in the space with Wasabi. I hope to have you back sometime to talk more Rothbard, We could do the whole what has government done to our money, amongst other works, as well as get into Wasabi and coin joining. And I hope to do that someday. But I'll leave it to you. Any parting words? And, you know, it was, I think I even heard that you did like 58 hours straight of podcasting at a conference recently. So, you know, sound off. You're doing Satoshi's work. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you a lot. Yeah, like that aspect of content creation really is a lot of fun. And I've been doing it for a while. Like, for example, by the way, like fans of your show are probably fans of Rothbard. On the World Crypto Network, like a couple of years ago, I did this show called Read Rothbard, Use Bitcoin. I had like talking about some, you know, Austrian or praxeological thinking specifically applied to Bitcoin. That was a lot of fun to do all these shows back in the day. And yeah, there was this conference, the Hackers Congress at Parallelnipolis. And I've been doing like coverage of that event with live streams for the last couple of years. But this year we did, yeah, as you said, that nonstop live stream. Not just me, I actually did very little of the content. I just got together like 30 different podcasters to, you know, host interesting interviews. So that was like also a fountain of knowledge. Yeah, but one of the like the parting notes I like to give currently is, like, we live in this phenomenal age of cyberspace where you can accumulate knowledge at barely any cost, right? You just have at your fingertips this massive library of information where you can read or listen to anything, right? From any author. It's quite astounding, but and very different to how we have like accumulated information before, right? Just 100 years ago, 50 years ago, you had to go like to libraries to like where only one copy of the book was, right? Very much different. So this gives us great power, but it also has the risk that we get stuck in simply accumulating that information and just continuously consuming and consuming and consuming and actually forgetting to think about the topic, right? Because you just press the next play next button on YouTube and, well, the next advertisement comes along, right? So what I just think, like, and I've experienced that by hosting a lot of podcasts, and I'm sure you can agree with these, is that once you actually speak about something, and once you act, and speech is a form of action, sure, you're kind of forced to think, right? Like, if you didn't really think about a topic before, well, as soon as you're like forced to speak about that topic, you're going to realize it that you have no clue, right? And that's when you get into an uncomfortable situation and actually start to think about the problem and try to find solutions to it. And so this aspect of interacting and, you know, thinking for yourself and speaking up is so important in reaching wisdom. And I it's awesome that we have so many Bitcoin podcasters out there who do create this knowledge, because again, in that creation of the knowledge itself is like the pure gold. And I would just really much encourage everyone to speak up and to act and to not just think about these topics of freedom, but to live as a free individual and to speak as one proudly and loudly. You know, hosting a podcast, great idea, right? Attending Socratic seminars, also a fantastic idea. So there are, yeah, I just cannot say that enough, but it's dangerous to only accumulate knowledge and to not think about it. And true wisdom can only come after that accumulated knowledge is understood and is acted upon.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I think, you know, one, digesting and accumulating knowledge is a good first step, but I agree that you can get sort of dogmatic and you're not engaging as critically. I think everyone should step up and contribute in any way they can. Podcasts, writing, all functions of the space. And I really appreciate everything you're doing. You're someone that I really look to in a much bigger way than just, but I think you're underappreciated. And I think you have so much to share, and I hope we get to do it again sometime.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the compliment, Cedric. And in general, that interview, like, really sharp. Like, you understand the topic to a great extent, and you can find the questions that will lead to an interesting conversation. And that's such a difficult skill. So I definitely see that you are quite advanced in mastering it, and really respect for that. But again, right, I think you've learned that skill by podcasting, right, by actually needing to ask the questions. It's something that you've worked for, but definitely the results show was a great conversation. Thanks a lot for inviting me on. If any of you just want to reach out and have further amazing conversations, you can find all my things at towardsliberty.com, specifically with a bunch of weekly seminars in the Socratic method, you know, about Bitcoin, about praxeology and entrepreneurship, about liberation strategies and operational security. Like a lot of things are being covered here. That's a kind invite for anyone to join these strong and healthy conversations.
Yeah, I appreciate your kind words, and I'm going to keep grinding. I'm loving learning about the art form, and I'm trying to learn up. But, you know, I think that, you know, definitely people should reach out to you and anyone else they have questions for and keep gaining the knowledge. And I think that we're going to have a lot more to talk about soon. I really want to get more into the technical stuff as we get into maybe episodes 50 through 100. And I think there's a lot more for us to learn on those fronts. And then there's more Rothbard. The world needs more Rothbard. So thank you so much, Max. This
absolutely
has been so dope. Thank you, man. Peace.
Max Hillebrand on the anatomy of the state, why the world needs more Rothbard, and his mantra, liberty or death, come and take it, right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dig the pod, please subscribe and rate with a dope 5-star review. Then share a link to the podcast with your friends and family. And if you need to start stacking stats or want the best place to DCA, plus get $10 of Bitcoin free on me, just sign up at swanbitcoin.com/Cedric Jungleman. That's the first step. This is Cedric. Peace.